This is music from Nicholas Payton via Miles Davis and Gil Evans. Welcome to The Checkout from WBGO. I'm Josh Jackson. Trumpeter Nicholas Payton takes on the mega duo's masterwork, Sketches of Spain, and revises it for today with the Symphony Orchestra Basel of Switzerland. Trumpeter Ambrose Akinwusiri speaks about the old soul in Ecclesiastes, the genius of singer Becca Stevens, and why he named his album The Imagined Savior is Far Easier to Paint. But first, it's Satchmo at the Waldorf. Louis Armstrong is off-Broadway, imagined by writer Terry Teachout and played by actor John Douglas Thompson. They join WBGO's Rhonda Hamilton up next. It's a Trumpeter trifecta on The Checkout. Thanks for checking in.
Currently at the West Side Theater in Manhattan, there is a play called Satchmo at the Waldorf, and my guest is the star of the show, John Douglas Thompson, and the play was written by my other guest, Terry Teachout, and it's a pleasure to have both of you gentlemen with us today.
We're glad to be here.
Did you know a lot about Louis Armstrong before you took this role?
No, not much. I mean, I knew of Hello, Dolly! And certainly Wonderful World from Good Morning, Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And remembering some clips of him on the Ed Sullivan Show, but very little. It was really Terry's book that once I began looking at the role and deciding to do the role that I started with that research. And Terry's book kind of really familiarized me with Armstrong, but led me in different directions as well. So I went to the Armstrong Museum, I went to the house, to the archives, and began to listen to tapes, some of the reel-to-reel tapes that he'd made, to get his voice and just hear Louis in his real self, in a sense.
Perhaps we should say that the play grew out of a biography of Armstrong.
Right, the book that you wrote, very extensive biography. Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of the material, you refer to the tapes, there's a, one of the things that you see in the play is that Louis Armstrong is there on the stage with a tape recorder, and this is something that he did. I mean, he really documented much of his life. And these tapes, many of them are available, right? And this is how you researched your book, Terry?
There are more than 600 of the tapes available in the Armstrong Archives at Queens College. Mm-hmm. And they're the most vivid documents imaginable because they show you the offstage Armstrong, not the guy that you remember from Ed Sullivan, the guy with a grin, but the guy who had sometimes very different attitudes from what you'd expect. Very tough-minded, sometimes very angry, very much aware of civil rights issues, a man who knew the score.
Well, what was it that inspired you to write the book in the first place about Louis Armstrong? Was it the tapes? Did you know about the tapes before you wrote the book?
Everybody knew about the tapes, but they weren't available. I was the first biographer who came along after the tapes had been conserved and made available for researchers. And it was knowing that they were there and that I could get at them that stimulated me to write a biography.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that he had a certain persona that a lot of people in the world knew. But of course, like all of us, he was a multidimensional person,
right.
You know,
right.
And certainly had gone through so much in his life growing up in the South, and the background that he had in particular, you know, was a rough one.
He saw it all.
Yeah.
He was born in the roughest part of Storyville in New Orleans. His mother was a prostitute. And then at the end of his life, everybody, as John says in the play, everybody in the world knew his name.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, when you conceived this play, Terry, did you think about it as having just one actor play all of these roles? Or
yes.
How did that evolve? Okay.
Well, the very first draft, which lasted for about a week, Armstrong was the only character in it. And then a friend of mine said, I know that you like plays where one person plays more than one character. Have you thought of trying that? And I immediately thought Glazer. And Miles Davis came along at a later stage in the writing. But as soon as the idea of having the actor switch between the black Armstrong and the white Glazer came to me, I realized, okay, now this is a play with conflict built into it.
For you, John, playing the role of Louis Armstrong, there's lots of material that you can draw from to, you know, figure out how to you're going to portray him. But what about Joe Glazer?
Well, all I had for Joe Glazer was what I could read about him, obviously, in Terry's book. And there were some other books that also mentioned Glazer. Also letters that Armstrong at the museum or at the archives, there are letters that Armstrong had written to Glazer And I also had an audio recording just of his voice. He was promoting some event out in, I think it was Hawaii. And then I also watched Little Caesar, movies of Edward G. Robinson, as a matter of fact, to begin to model my voice and carriage after.
Well, we should mention that Glazer was connected with
the mob, connected with Al Capone.
Up to his eyebrows.
Very deep, you know. And so that movie kind of gave me some insight, at least, into that type of a character. And he was very tough, as he's represented in the play, and really strongholded many of his clients and people that he dealt with. And I also talked to a young man. Well, he's much older now. He's in his 70s, but he was 16. He worked as a junior accountant in Associated Booking Corporation, which is Joe Glazer's company. And he sat behind. He worked in an office that was behind Joe Glazer, and he heard Glazer on the phone almost all day, and said, "This guy," he said, "I can't even give you a contemporary as to how bad this gentleman was and how he treated people on the phone and the words that he used. He was a racist, a misogynist. I mean, he was all of those things." And no one really stood up to him. So I had that person's insight as well, who sat right behind Glazer in another office.
But yet there was this friendship between him and Louis Armstrong.
Very
but
complicated.
Again, a complicated relationship that they had.
And they, both men, as Terry knows and I know, have had a great deal of love for each other. But it's very complex, their relationship, and race has a lot to do with it, obviously.
And that's where the tension in the play comes from, is that these are two people who love and trust each other, but it's across this gulf of race, this gulf of experience. And in the end, Armstrong comes to feel, with reason, that Glazer has betrayed him.
So it's a love story with betrayal, obviously, being the crux.
Like all the best love stories.
And that's how you really look at it, as a kind of a love story.
I certainly hope, within the context of performing the play, that the audiences feel that. That all, as rough as Glazer was, and as beautiful as Armstrong was, and how different these two men were. You couldn't imagine two men like this being in the same room together. And I've read from various accounts that sometimes they couldn't be in the same room together, that they hated each other on some moments and they loved each other in others, you know. But it was a long 40-year relationship, you know. And Armstrong never really knew another manager once he got with Glazer. And Glazer took care of everything for him, you know, not just booking him in various places and putting him out on the road, but all of his many issues in Armstrong's personal life, Glazer also tended to, so that Armstrong could just basically go out and play music.
Let's listen to some of Louis Armstrong's music. This is a piece I asked both of my guests, playwright Terry Teachout and actor John Douglas Thompson, who stars in the role of Louis Armstrong in the play. It's Satchmo at the Waldorf. It's at the West Side Theater in Manhattan. But I asked both of you to choose some of your favorite Armstrong recordings. And John, one of the ones you chose was West End Blues.
Yes.
And why this song? I mean, it's one of the iconic performances.
Seminal. I had, you know, as I said earlier, my familiarity with Armstrong was like Hello, Dolly and Wonderful World. And as I got into this and I could understand his trumpet virtuosity and what he did as a young man early on when he began to play. And this, there's something so incredible about this piece, because technically it's perfect, you know. And the introduction to the song is something I've never, ever heard before. I don't think I'll ever hear it again. So that really—that's the hook. The introduction of the song is amazing, and he does a little bit of scatting as well. So I think it really shows off all of Armstrong in his brilliance. My guests today are playwright Terry Teachout. He's written a work
called Satchmo at the Waldorf. It stars John Douglas Thompson, and they are both with me in the studio, and we're talking about Louis Armstrong and the play and hearing some of their favorite recordings. And Terry, you chose a piece called Hotter Than That.
I chose it because of the joyousness of the thing. It's just one of these flying performances from the late 20s when his feet never touched the ground. I've described Armstrong before as a major key artist, somebody whose view of the world, however realistic it is in some fundamental sense optimistic. And you feel this in Hotter Than That. It just, you know, and there he's off.
Yeah. Don't go to this play expecting to hear a lot of music, because it's not really about that. It's about the inner lives of these
right.
two.
It's not a musical play, although there are important musical moments in
yes.
the play.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
I, you know, the story is really the man behind the horn. And if we were going to do a play about Armstrong, and you wanted to kind of approach him from not the public persona that everybody's very familiar with, but from some other aspect of Armstrong that's just as interesting, mm-hmm. if not even more fascinating.
What did you find the most surprising or unexpected about Louis Armstrong?
Well, there's a segment on the tapes that Terry had me listen to and I'll let Terry do the setup, but I will just tell you, it was so raw that I started to realize there's a lot more to Armstrong than I ever imagined. So I'll let Terry
do
the setup.
This is not a play for children. And this is actually a bit that we ended up putting into the play. But he was with a group of people. And he says, very matter-of-factly, that two-thirds of all white people don't like, and then he uses the N-word, mm-hmm. which is, you know, something that he used very commonly. And then he says, but they all got one they're crazy about. Do the line, John.
They all got one they just crazy about. Every white man in the world got one, I won't say the word, N-word, they just love his dirty draws.
And then the audience explodes in laughter, but it's nervous laughter because, you know, you've got an audience full, mm-hmm. usually, of white people as mm-hmm. well as black people.
Mm-hmm. And it's acknowledged.
Yeah, and they realize he's talking about you, pal.
Mm-hmm. But I'm also thinking about the tape.
Oh, the funny one.
The funny one where he's trying to get his wife, Lucille, to go to sleep with him after a party because he left the tape machine on.
Yeah, that's a great moment.
Still recording.
Yeah, they're in a hotel room somewhere in the 50s. It's 3 in the morning, and Louis wants his wife to take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
She's not interested. It's too late. Mm-hmm. And then she notices the tape recorder is on. And she says, you turn that off. You erase that. And he says right back to her, I can't do that. It's for posterity. And I remember very well the first time I heard this tape. And I'm sitting there, you know, with the headphones on. And suddenly it hits me. That's me. I'm posterity. I'm the person, the kind of person that Armstrong preserved this tape for. And the reason why he preserved it is because even though he was a very modest man, he knew what he was. He was Louis Armstrong. And he knew that the future would be interested in what he was really like as a man.
Terry Teachout and John Douglas Thompson's Satchmo at the Waldorf, directed by Gordon Edelstein, is now playing at Manhattan's West Side Theater. Coming up next, Ambrose Akinmusere's The Imagined Savior is far easier to paint. The very real trumpeter and his extremely broad brush is up next. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson.
Thank you. Ambrose.
Yes.
Akinmusiri.
Ambrose Akinmusiri.
Ambrose Akinmusiri. How many people mispronounce your name still?
Oh, I would say 97, 98%. But I'm used to it. I'm really into what people come up with.
I bet this could be a very fun game.
Yes. I mean, well, there's a clear winner. Asia Mafire.
Asia?
Asia Mafire.
Asia Mafire.
Asia Mafire. I was on a tour with John Escreet, and when I checked into the hotel, they didn't have my name there. And I said, okay, well, do you have anything under the letter A? And they said, well, we have an Ambrose Asia Mafire. A-J-A Fire.
A-J-A Fire. So part Steely Dan.
Exactly.
And part Earth, Wind, and Fire.
I guess that's, yeah. No, but that's definitely by far the funniest. I guess that's not a mispronunciation. That's just a misspelling or just a miss something. But that's been the best one.
I like that, you know, as much as, you know, your visibility has increased, you know, relative to your artistic output, that you still sort of get leveled by the fact that people are blowing it on your name. Like, that to me is...
Oh. Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts of the show.
I don't know if there's a favorite part of, for me, of this recording. I like quite a bit of it, actually.
Thank you.
The imagined savior is far easier to paint. Why do you laugh?
Oh, because I know the next question. I'm going to say, what does that mean?
What does the title mean?
Well, it means something very specific to me, but I'm not into making things concrete, especially with art. Once you tell somebody it's this thing, they can only experience it in that one way. So I wanted to make a title that allowed people space to interpret it.
In the fleeting blush, between dusk and afterlight, your eyes were aglow like two moons. Then your smile shot through me, tranquilizing all the ache. And now I'm higher than the street lights, fading on beneath the night sky's blue. I imagine you calming one part of a song that you like, singing out the words that move you down the avenue while I watched you walk past me. No drug can escape this relentless heat. A familiar sound passing by cools everything, and I hide my face behind the shame of all the sins that keep that sound from me. And imagine you doing simple things like humming one part of a song that you like, singing out the words that move you down the avenue while I watched you walk.
Our Basement, Ed, Ambrose Akinmusiri featuring singer Becca Stevens from his album The Imagined Savior Is Far Easier to Paint.
Can we talk about Becca Stevens?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, she's the genius of my generation.
Why do you say that?
Just because she's so ridiculous. I mean, and she already has her own voice, and she knows who she is, and she always has.
I told her one time that I thought she had the high lonesome. Do you know what that is? Why are you laughing?
Yeah, I know what that is.
That's just my impression, you know. But she has a distinctive voice.
She definitely
You are
does.
Correct.
She just can... You know, the mark of genius is not being able to do everything. It's really being able to... be who you are in any situation. I know that with her, she is definitely always connected. Even in just hanging out with her, even just goofing around, there's still a certain energy that she projects that's just unbelievable and inspiring. But I felt that way about her when I first met her in like 2002. I was just like, okay, yeah, you're on some other stuff. You're just, okay, you're otherly, you know. And I really feel that about her. You know, when people ask me when I travel around, you know, they say, so who should I be checking out? And for years, I've always said Becca Stevens.
Who are the people in this band? And tell me one thing about each one of them that makes them special. Not in necessarily a musical way, but...
Oh, wow. One thing, man. Wow.
Just one thing.
With Harish Raghavan on bass, he... Man, I think I would probably say the exact same thing about everybody in the band. It's just everybody's willingness to explore and not have their egos on the table.
Harish gets a spot in Bubbles.
Yes. Yes. He actually plays the role of Bubbles tap dancing right there. We took a take, and he took an amazing solo, because that's what Harish does. But it wasn't the right vibe for the song, at least I thought. And I just looked at him and I said, well, now pretend you're Bubbles taking a tap dance solo.
Who is Bubbles?
Bubbles is one of the baddest tap dancers ever. Just the rhythms that he was tapping was amazing. So I found like 7 or 8 rhythms from YouTube, and I made an audio sample of them. Then I transcribed the audio samples, and I came up with a pitch order. I put the pitch order over the rhythms, and it became the song Bubbles, which sort of sounds like an exhibition on a theme or something. But it's really 2 or 3 different shifting pitch order things with 7 or 8 rhythmic patterns.
Bubbles, featuring bassist Harish Raghavan as the legendary tap dancer John William Sublett. Trumpeter Ambrose Akinmusiri joins us on the checkout.
This isn't like how you always compose, I'm assuming.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. And actually, the explanation sounds way more complicated than the actual process. Yeah, it wasn't that deep.
What gives you the impetus to think of something like that?
It just comes to me.
You're sitting there watching a YouTube video of this guy, Sublett, and saying, man, those rhythms are incredible.
Not even. You know, I guess I never thought about this, but I guess my first reaction is always physical. So if I'm watching him, maybe I'll start tapping something and say, oh, wait a minute. Okay, I'm having a certain reaction to this. Maybe I should do something to it. You know, it's just like if I'm humming something, it's more than likely I've been humming it before for a long time before I realized I was humming it, before the mental process. So with this particular thing, I think I was just watching a bunch of clips and I was tapping certain rhythms, and I said, okay, let me go back and see what those rhythms are and transcribe them.
Is music a contact for you? Is it about contact?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have an answer to that. I do allow music to affect me in whatever way it wants to affect me. I don't try to control that. If I had to say music was about anything, it's about expressing this higher thing. I know that's not your question, but you know, the older I get, the more I realize that's what it is. It's the sound of this thing that we have faith in. You know, it's the voice of something higher. And I'm not even talking about Jesus or God or anything like that, because I don't know if I even necessarily believe in that, but I do believe in this thing higher than everybody else, or the great mind, like this one universal mind that's kind of going around that everybody taps into every now and then. And some people are able to hold on to it for long periods of time. And I think that's what happens in jazz bands, you know, when everybody's playing and all of a sudden everybody's for two or three bars plays the exact same thing. That's when everybody happens to tap into the great mind. And I think the thing we're all practicing and writing for and collaborating with each other for is to get a hold of that and hold on. And I think there's been many artists that I look up to who have been able to ride that a little bit longer than the average person, you know, like someone like a Coltrane or even a Booker Little or a Clifford Brown or a Joni Mitchell or a Wayne Shorter, you know, Wayne. You know, you know, there's people, certain people who are able to really hitch
be
a
the
ride.
Vessel.
Yeah, be the vessel and hitch a ride on a great mind.
The Beauty of Dissolving Portraits. Ambrose Ekinmusiri joins us on the checkout. The Imagined Savior is far easier to paint, Blue Note Records. You said, as it relates to this title, The Imagined Savior is far easier to paint, that, you know, in terms of an artistic output, there is no definitive way to take something. Let's go with Ecclesiastes 6:10, which I think Ecclesiastes, you tell me, I find it to be one of the most soulful books of the Bible.
Oh, definitely, by far.
Why?
It just sounds like, you know, when I read that or when I read it, it sounds like an old Southern person talking to me. You know, it's just, even just the language that she uses, it's just, you know, you meet older people and they're really hopeful and just really carefree. And I feel like that part of the Bible is like that. You know, it's just like, don't worry. You know, everything is ordered. You know, you don't have control over anything, but that's supposed to be freeing for you. The resilience in that part of the Bible.
Ecclesiastes 6:10. Whatever exists has already been named, and what man is has been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he.
Right.
Here's the Southern version of that, as someone from the South. It is what it is.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Or even, slaves or super old people from the South, like, this is bad, but it will get better because, you know, there's something higher than us that has things ordered. It's the blues, that's what that is.
You feel like the blues has a higher spiritual purpose?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Do you hear it when you play your trumpet?
I hear it when it comes through me. I feel it when it comes through me. I don't really listen to what comes out of my horn.
What does it feel like?
It's a horrible answer, but it just feels like I'm full when it's inside of me.
Feels like you're full.
Just full, yeah. That's the best way to describe it. Just like I can feel something coming inside of me. It doesn't happen every time, but, you know, when I'm at my best or it, you know, I've allowed myself to be clean enough or pure enough for it to actually enter me, it definitely feels like a full feeling.
Thank you.
Ambrose Akinmusiri's J.E. Nilma, Ecclesiastes, from his album The Imagined Savior Is Far Easier to Paint, from Blue Note Records. The core group includes tenor saxophonist Walter Smith III, drummer Justin Brown, bassist Harish Raghavan, pianist Sam Harris, and guitarist Charles Altura. Coming up next, Nicholas Payton's take on Sketches of Spain. He also tells WBGO's Awilda Rivera why he calls his music BAM instead of jazz. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson.
Trumpeter, multi-instrumentalist, Grammy Award winner Nicholas Payton has recorded and released Sketches of Spain on his very own label.
Yes.
BMF Records. Sketches of Spain is an album by Miles Davis with his one of many collaborations with Gil Evans. Recorded 1959, 1960. It is a seminal recording in the history of jazz. It's a daunting undertaking. Why Sketches of Spain now?
Good question. They asked me to do it. It was a live recording done in Basel, Switzerland with the Symphony Orchestra Basel. And originally I was asked to perform my first symphonic work that I wrote called The Black American Symphony. And they wanted to try to tie it into a larger contextual thing. So they said, how about playing Sketches of Spain? I said, sure, that would be cool. So the orchestra opened up with some Duke Ellington. We played Sketches of Spain immediately after, took an intermission, and then we played my symphony with full 73-piece orchestra.
Wait a minute, you did both?
Yes.
At the same time?
Yes.
What, did you take a vacation for a month after that?
Man, I mean.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, people, well, yeah.
That's not in the liner notes.
Yeah,
that's...
I mean, just to do one of those. Yeah,
wow.
It's in there.
I missed
it. Yeah, you know, just to do one
you
of them. Is, yeah.
Both at the same time?
Yeah. You know, secretly, I didn't say anything to anybody. I was afraid. I was like, am I going to be able to do this? You know, and, you know, just mentally, I just had to prepare. It's like, it's an equivalent of like a marathon or something like that kind of discipline and training. So, I mean, immediately before that, it was a certain headspace and practicing and so forth. But my whole life experience is what I brought to it. You know, almost 40 years at that point of understanding of, you know, pacing. And I've played sketches before, so I sort of knew how to pace myself. Because the challenging thing about this work is these pieces were not really performed live by Miles. He did like an excerpt here and there, but to have the horn to your face virtually 90 to 95% of the 40 minutes, that's a daunting task because you don't normally do that in a playing situation. You take a solo for 5-10 minutes, and you sit to the side, and the piano player plays or someone else. But on this piece, you're featured pretty much throughout the whole time. And you don't get to the peak of it until the end when you get to Soleil.
Soleil,
right. So you got to be thinking the whole time, like, I'm not done yet. So it's like a big incline, and you hit this peak.
Handful of cats who have recorded Sketches of Spain. I mean, my mind, the two that come to mind, two that I really dig is Lou Soloff's.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Belden did Miles Español, yes. Sketches of Spain. That was off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
Two CDs chock full of Miles Español. Yours is, I think, is the only live one I recall.
To my knowledge.
Because I looked and I couldn't find another live one. What were the challenges recording a live Sketches of Spain as opposed to doing it in the studio?
You only got that opportunity to get it,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, in the studio, you just do another take. This was, you know, we performed it twice, two nights, so.
Thank you.
From Sketches of Spain, the Pan Piper, Nicholas Payton. How easy, how difficult is it to give your spin to a masterpiece? I can't believe that it could be so easy.
Obviously, there's a lot of respect there that I have mm-hmm. for both Miles and Gil, but we certainly weren't going in trying to redo what they did. I mean, obviously, they did that, and mm-hmm. you're not going to do what they did being them better. So you got to sort of find yourself in it. It was 2013, so my idea was like to let the listeners know that it's 2013 and there's that distance between when Miles and Gil did it and when we're doing it.
Well, we're going to talk about the elephant in the room. I got a couple of tweets, and you're going to talk to Nicholas about BAM. Back in 2011, I think that you've always had a blog.
Since 2008, yes.
When you wrote a piece on why jazz isn't cool anymore, mm-hmm. that was quite a backlash. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with it?
I didn't set out for it to have.
Did you expect that backlash?
No. I post a lot of essays and things on my page because I think it's important as artists for us to have a social responsibility and a responsibility to the community. I mean, that's what this music is supposed to be about. And this is why I favor Black American music to the jazz idea, which to me is a thing about marketing and such. That, you know, it's important to remember the roots and the community from which this comes from, mm-hmm. because without that, none of this means anything. And artists need to step up, particularly now that we're losing so many of the great masters of
Absolutely.
The golden era. It's, you know, I don't consider myself an old man, but I've found that I had to step up and be a voice in places where no one's saying anything. And I can't just allow things to happen that I know cats like Ray Brown and Hank Jones and Elvin Jones, that they wouldn't have tolerated. They wouldn't have tolerated. They kept stuff in check a certain way. So now it's become incumbent upon me and others, whatever few cats who do mm-hmm. speak up, to make sure that stuff doesn't go completely haywire. They pass the torch to us, and many of them are gone or leaving every day. If we don't do it, then who's going to do it? We're the link between the younger cats now who never got a chance to see the Art Blakeys and so forth. Who's going to be that voice? We have to do it.
This is a great quote from you. I play Black American music, which is not a genre. To me, this includes everything from James Brown to Miles Davis and Marvin Gaye to Stan Getz, Chet Baker, to Charles Davis, Ray Charles, you know, the whole continuum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a lot of people took, like I was trying to say, that only Black people can play the music, and that was not, it was not a thing, a divisive thing of saying who can and can't play or who can and cannot listen to it or support it. It's just an acknowledgement and a recognition of who created this music. Because what we can't forget is that a lot of these artists weren't allowed to stay at the same hotel they had gigs in. That they couldn't go through the front entrance or fraternize with the guests. And a lot of people sacrificed a lot and died for us to have the rights that we have today. So it's very important that we don't forget.
Now we're going to hear another piece from Sketches of Spain. Nicholas Payton with his regular band featuring Vicente Archer, Marcus Gilmore, Daniel Sedonic with the Symphony Orchestra.
Basel.
It's Basel?
Basel, yes.
Basel. I always think about how to say Basel. Will O' the Wisp.
Will-O-The-Wisp, played by Nicholas Payton with Symphony Orchestra Basel of Switzerland from BMF Records. The Checkout is a podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. While you're there, give us a rating or a review. That way, more people can see us. All of our programs are available online. Stream us at checkoutjazz.org and share us with your friends. You can follow us on Twitter, at checkoutjazz. The producer is Simon Rentner. He's on Twitter, too, at Simon Rentner. Special thanks to production assistant Joyce Kwan. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Josh Jackson. Thanks for listening.